welcome to Curmudgeon's Corner for Monday, December 14th, 2009. I'm Sam Minter. I have Yvonne Bo with me. Hello, Yvonne.
Hey, hello.
So today we're only going to do three 10-minute segments, so let's get right on it. The first topic that both of us agreed on was let's talk about the Google phone. And so for those of you who haven't seen within the last week, there was pretty much confirmation that there is a Google phone coming, and that means not just an Android phone, but an Android phone that is Google-branded, that is not co-branded with anybody else. It looks like it's probably going to be sold unlocked as opposed to with a carrier. It's going to be sold by Google themselves. There are all kinds of rumors about exactly what it would be, but apparently in the last week, Google gave a whole bunch of these out to their employees to like go out and test. And
let me ask a question. Yeah. Do we know an employee who has one?
I do not know if we know an employee who has one.
I guess
one.
We never asked.
A, we have not asked, and B, he was probably under an NDA of some sort if he has one.
Well, here's the thing. I'm not sure about that. I mean, one of the
bloggers
that have talked about actually having the phones.
That's true. I don't know. But, I imagine, I imagine when Google handed them out, they probably said something along the lines of, you know, we want to build some buzz here, so feel free to say that you have one and that it looks cool and stuff like that, but no details, please. You know?
Okay.
But, okay. Whatever. Look, whether or not we know someone who has one, here's the thing.
Well, I mean, at least I just to wonder, I mean, what they could tell us about it, you know?
I don't know. Anyway, look. Here's the game-changing things if the rumors are true. One is
There are some, just for everybody, an Engadget, okay? Yeah. There are actually,
there are pictures.
Apparently, some sample photographs.
Yes, there are some pictures of this thing. Yes. You know, but look, here are the potential game-changing things, like if the rumors are true. Rumor number one is that this thing is going to be sold not tied to a specific carrier. It's going to be sold unlocked, sold by Google. The carriers might support it, but it's not going to be, you know, an exclusive blah blah blah. It's unlocked. You grab your phone separate from the plan and move on. That's one changer.
That's a game changer in the U.S.
Well, right. It is
that
not,
is not
everywhere.
A game changer in a lot of places in Europe and in Asia.
No.
Okay.
But look, here's the other part that is going to be interesting, and I don't know whether, you know, these parts of the rumors are true or not, but the place where it could really be a game changer is if it was sold as a data only device and all phone calls were VoIP via Google Voice.
If that were the case. Now,
if
the question is, of course, but now I know only, I'm thinking about how carriers have positioned themselves in the marketplace. There's only one carrier that I've ever heard that was making a hint of trying to do that. And that was, AT&T did talk a little bit about doing that when they said that they were going to allow Skype to work over their data network a couple of months ago, which hasn't in reality happened, okay? Even though they said they would allow it, okay? Mm-hmm. The other network that talked about that was Verizon, because Verizon talked about a year or two ago about changing their network so they're just really a carrier of data and that people could develop and put whatever applications they want on the network. However, if neither of the networks allow that to be done, it's irrelevant whether they want the phone to work that way or not.
That, yeah.
I mean, if the carrier chooses to block that functionality, you're out there, you know, big brick.
It depends. It depends what they do. I mean, if they sell it with the more expensive data only plan, kind of like if they sell it the same way they sell the dongles that go into your laptop for 3G, then once you're doing it, I mean, for the most part, they haven't been so far doing sort of deep packet inspection to block specific things. What they've done instead is have a bandwidth cap that when you hit a when you hit more than like 5 gigs a month or whatever,
boom, it blocks you. Yep.
It either blocks you or it starts,
or it charges you.
It charges you insane amounts of money. So yes. I don't know what we'll see here, and like it may. That's why I think look, it's probably going to come with regular, unlocked voice happening with just the other stuff is maybe a possibility, but it's gonna. There are a lot of interesting things about this. It's also like one of the things that's mentioned is unlike the Android phones that are out there right now, where they start with the open source Android platform, but then each of the carriers does some customization and adds some stuff of their own. The handset makers do the same. This is going to be like the iPhone is for Apple. This is going to be start to end Google envisioned and managed. They have a, it looks like HTC is the people who are actually going to physically be making it, but it's not going to be an HTC branded phone. It's spec'd out by Google. The software is spec'd out by Google. They are controlling the whole end-to-end experience, and they're really, it looks like they're serious about going out after Apple here and trying something new here. So,
well, here's a couple of things about this, okay? One thing that people got to remember is that the iPhone, in order in the U.S. to have the pricing it really has, it has a huge subsidy,
right.
Okay? You try to sell a phone, really a device, with a kind of technology that Apple's packing in the iPhone, the retail cost surges to $700, $800.
Right.
The question is, okay, you want to sell the phone unlocked and you want to actually pack that much technology, Google would have two choices. A, lose a lot of money on selling each device up front with the expectation that they'll make it up
later
somewhere, somehow, I don't know.
Yep.
Okay? Or B, they decontent the phone and start dropping features. I mean, I'm not sure. Or, those are the two options. I'm assuming that they're thinking, and this could be something regarding to this. I mean, let's face it. The iPhone itself, aside from the revenue from the minutes and the communication, has become a big revenue stream for Apple because it makes people buy songs. It makes people buy applications. It makes people do a lot of things through a marketplace that Apple controls that generates a lot of secondary revenue.
Yeah.
So,
Nothing on their initial sale either, but yes, the secondary is a huge.
But the secondary is a big revenue stream.
Do they still get a proportion of the monthly fees from AT&T too, or was that only the first?
I think that was only on the first phone, and then they changed. Remember to the different model, yep. Which was the one that all the carriers, because although the other carriers balked at that kind of model. So remember that the original iPhone, the first one was not actually subsidized.
Right.
Okay. That's why the price was high, okay, at the time. And the way that they've got the price to go down, even though they've launched newer phones with more technology, is by, having the carrier subsidize it in part and going with the standard model. So, it'll be interesting to see what they try to do with this unlocked phone. Now, as I mentioned, in Europe, it's very common in a lot of countries that you buy phones separately from the service.
Yes.
Okay. That is the standard model, and that is the standard model in a lot of countries in Asia. Apple actually sells the iPhone unlocked in a number of countries.
Yep.
And that is one
at
of the biggest
sources. At a higher price, of course.
At a higher price, and that is the biggest sources of you being able to actually get your hands on a legal unlocked iPhone if you would choose to do so. But I don't know if that, like I said, I think it's very complicated, especially for the American consumer to go when you go to AT&T and you see that you can get the basic iPhone for $99 or a refurbished, higher end model for $99 and to justify yourself paying $600, $500, $400.
Right. To have it unlocked and where in the U.S., if you're talking a GSM phone, you're pretty much, it's only AT&T and T-Mobile. It's not like you're going to hop onto Verizon or Sprint.
You're not going to – or Sprint, right. You know, so it really is, you know, it really is kind of, you know, for the U.S. market, I think, you know, going to the rest of the world market, that's a different proposition. So, and, you know, we got to think about the fact that the rest of the world market is becoming more important to...
Right. So anyway, it's time for a break. So let's just sum this up by saying, look, there are a lot of rumors out here. It looks like these things are in the wild. There are a few pictures. We'll find out what's going on for real. It's the rumors are this thing's going to launch and be available for sale in January. That they had hoped to have it out for Christmas, but missed that deadline, and now it's January. So we'll know very soon what's real and what's not about this. My expectation is they may be selling it unlocked, but it's probably essentially just going to be an Android 2.1 phone with you know, a few bits of extra Google magic around it and the Google branding, and we'll see where it goes. But you know, it's definitely a sign of Google jumping in here with more feet than it has before. Anyway, we'll take a break, and we'll talk a little bit more about Google versus Apple when we get back.
AfricaFocus.org features high-quality analysis and progressive advocacy on African issues with a particular attention to priority issues affecting the entire continent. The heart of the website is the Africa Focus Bulletin. Other features include regularly updated Africa-related news feeds and a set of country pages with extensive background and links on each African country. If you follow African issues or are even curious, visit AfricaFocus.org today.
And we're back. So, you know, it looks like, you know, and we talked about the Google phone coming up against the iPhone, but that looks like it's just one of several things that's going on right now where Google and Apple are bumping heads more. And of course, we used to have Schmidt from Google on Apple's board. He resigned a few months ago because the two companies are more and more coming into places where they're competing with each other. And the Google phone is certainly one symptom of that. But, you know, a couple other things that were in the news this last week. One was Apple's acquisition of Lala.
Yes.
Which is a music streaming company, which, of course, lends all kinds of things about, okay, they're gonna enable all kinds of streaming stuff in iTunes so that, yeah, this is also a potential like game changer. Imagine if on your iPhone you didn't have to have a whole lot of onboard storage because it would automatically sort of stream stuff that you legally owned on your home computer without you actually having to have onboard copies on your phone, you know, and things like that. So there are all kinds of interesting possibilities like that. There's also a subscription model, blah, 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 you know, whatever. Anyway, but the point here is that as it turns out, it looks like Apple snapped up the company when Google was also in negotiations to buy them.
Yeah, I didn't know that part.
Yes.
And apparently, well, there was some mention, and I'd heard this weekend, I guess nobody referred directly to Lala, that Apple and Google have been shopping around companies that they've been butting heads and competing in purchasing technology in other companies. And not just that, but, you know, Google, Apple, and actually a few of the other Silicon Valley companies, you know, I was talking, and I guess I can talk about this now, you know, we're talking about, for example, how Google is also pushing a lot of the concepts in terms of data center design, okay, mm-hmm. you know, for example. And, you know, they're also talking about how they're patenting everything that they can patent their you know, that they – any freaking idea. I mean, I think the guy that I talked to, who I'm not going to mention his name, but he told me, Jesus, you know, I mean, I told him, how about if we build a data center, a floating data center? Oh, Google already patented that. I'm like, what? Oh, yeah. Above water, underwater, under. I'm like, what? How, you know? And he said, listen, the only thing they haven't patented is a data center on my dick. Okay.
Well, you know,
this is reply.
I mean,
I was like, okay.
We can talk about that for Google, but I mean, fundamentally, this is a standard part of tech company infrastructure at this point. But I
think it's
patent
like
anything you have ideas about.
Really getting on top of, you know, Google, Apple, HP, even IBM, a whole bunch of these really overlapping and fighting in a lot of things. Now, I'll tell you one thing that I find about Google's approach with this phone in terms of competitive vis-a-vis, okay, they want to compete versus Apple because obviously Apple has a lot more control with their telephone partners in terms of having their presence It's not, you know, the T-Mobile phone as they have now with the G1, but they want their fucking name to be really out there and their name to be the prominent one when something's bought and sold.
I'll tell you once again, we mentioned this a few months ago, going back to the Google phone thing. If they had really wanted to own this kind of stuff, when they were doing the damn auction, they shouldn't have just thrown in their name to try to get some policies. They should have tried to win the bandwidth.
Sure.
You know?
Sure.
Because if Google had actually bought up a huge chunk of spectrum to do with what they pleased, you know, they could have said, you know, screw it, we're doing the all data network. And yeah, everybody's going to have it, and we'll build it out. And
I got to tell you something. I know that Google was.
They've got money to throw around.
Not that. I mean, I'm sorry. But as the internet bubble proved, you may think you have all the money to throw around, but there are limits. I mean, let's face it. Building from scratch a cellular network right now, you're talking about. I think you're probably talking about, for a nationwide network in the U.S., probably about $100 billion.
Well, here's one of the things. The bandwidth that was under auction is amenable to different types of usage of the spectrum, where you could use fewer towers to cover the same area.
Okay, say 30.
It would be a lot.
Say $30 billion, $40 billion. Still a lot of dough. Where you're not even having a return assured. To plow into something like this, here's the thing that I'm wondering, that I'm a little bit like, Google seems to be shooting in every direction, and I'm not sure whether this is such a great strategy, because first you sign up a partner like Motorola to co-brand a phone and to go with Verizon and to go push something like really with your name, because if you see the billboards for the Droid, you know, they've got Motorola's name, they got Verizon name, they got Google name prominently on there. All of a sudden you wind up and you turn around after a couple of months of launching this, you're basically launching somewhat of a little flank attack around them.
Around the people you were partnering with a few months earlier, yes.
Yes, and I'm you know, and here's the other part. You know, it's not like Apple is not using a company like HTC to build their phones. They're using electronics manufacturers, period, which everybody does to that. However, going right now and going to HTC to ask them to build a phone, when HTC themselves has been moving out of that shadow and becoming a formidable cell phone builder themselves.
Right. They're converting from someone who just built the hardware and other people brand it to a brand that people actually look for.
Exactly. And I'm a little bit like, you know, geez, you know, are they trying? You know, they seem to be shooting in too many directions at once, okay? I mean, they got to either pick one strategy and follow that one because, I think that in one sense, I mean, you know, in the face of trying to do this, well, Apple's got the head. Apple's got the lead. Apple's got the lead. What the fuck we do? I mean, you can't go and fight five fronts at the same time and then pick even more enemies in the process, okay? I don't know. I don't know. I mean, I don't know if you agree with that assessment, but that's what it seems to me. Okay,
I don't know. We'll see how it plays out. I mean, there's certainly a thing about, you know, pissing off, you know, your partners. You know, if you feel in the end you still need them. I mean, maybe Google feels like they're in a position where they can, you know, they can start striking out on their own. I mean, remember Apple did some sort of deal with, like, was it Motorola? For the first, like, iTunes
phone? For the first, yes, that's true. Yes,
you know,
they did.
And you know, it was crap and nobody bought it. And then, you know, Apple said, screw that, we're doing our own. You know, and maybe Google is at the point where they feel like, you know, that these partnerships are actually holding them back and they can do better on their own.
Maybe. No, I agree. That could be, and that could be a good, that's a good assessment. I think that may be part of the case, that they think that they're not getting enough out of these partnerships. However, it just seems like, okay, think about this. So they came out with the G1, then they had the one after that. That one is a GSM phone. The Droid is a CDMA phone.
Yeah.
Okay. Now they're going to come out with an unlocked GSM phone. I think they've got, you know, I think that the one thing is that at some point they got to come out first with one phone that people really like and then figure out how to get it into a lot of people's hands.
Right.
You know, instead of continuing to, you know, develop so many different ones, you know, I guess that's my thing. I don't know.
And again, that might be part of what they're doing here is consolidating and saying, you know, okay, yeah, we were doing all this stuff, but now there is going to be the Google phone.
Okay.
You know, or okay, whatever they end up calling it.
If that's going to be their final sticking strategy, then that's okay. Now, I will
tell
you
what you're
worried
about is they keep changing and trying to do simultaneous things. You know, and just to bring it back real quick to the versus Apple thing, you know, they are competing on other fronts too. I mean, some of the other things that were mentioned were, you know, apparently there was a small company that's doing ad placements inside of iPhone apps and other mobile apps that both Apple and Google were going after. There's another, like, I think it's a VoIP vendor of some sort that it looks like they were both going after. You know, so there are a bunch of areas where, you know, Google wants to get into music too, and maybe, who knows? You know, so there's all kinds of areas where they're potentially bumping heads. And of course, you know, you got the two of them. You also got Microsoft still sitting out there trying to do their thing. And, you know, so it's an interesting sort of three-way dance between the three of them. And yeah, I don't know. I mean, there's definitely a lot of interesting stuff going on right now.
I just, you know, I mean, Microsoft is also coming out with a brand new, totally new OS for phones in the next few months, okay? You know, they're targeting it sometime, I think, in the middle of next year.
And meanwhile, of course, Palm gave sort of their last shot, and it looked pretty good, but I'm not sure it's going anywhere.
Well, I'm not sure it's going anywhere simply because I think they gave a last shot when they were almost, you know, the ship was sinking, you know.
Yeah, well, it was the last Palm, lots of people tend to agree. It's a pretty decent phone, actually, and it's got a lot of interesting stuff. And basically the word was, you know, if this had come out a year and a half, two years earlier, then it would have been hot competition for the iPhone. But it's a couple years too late. So even though it's decent and offers a few things that are new and different, nobody's really going to go there. Except
the rumors I heard was that Dell is apparently was shopping around, snooping to see if they might buy Palm. That was a rumor that I heard a couple of weeks ago. Hmm. So, you know, which could be, you know, think about to throw another one into the mix, because as you can see, Dell has been going around buying stuff because they haven't been able to figure out how to do anything. So one of the options they were coming up is to buy Palm.
Okay, well, we're out of time for this segment, so enough of tech. And I guess when we come back, we're going to be talking about Copenhagen a little bit.
Copenhagen. Copenhagen.
Yeah. Okay, we'll be right back.
This is the Curmudgeon's Corner Poem of the Week, brought to you by Notel Motel. Neon, N.E., by Deborah Poe. 6. New York City, Saigon. Consuming, air-drawn, homeless light. Cher Ferrer, draw back the signs. December's briars iced, distilled trees, merchandise-less field, neon traces, ghosts, erasure's laugh, gesture, reddish-orange tracts, the bone lottery blink drones on. For more like this, go to notelmotel.org with a new poet each week and a new poem every weekday.
Okay, one last segment, and I guess we're going to talk about the environment and Copenhagen and like all that kind of stuff. So why don't you kick it off, Yvonne? What do you think about all this stuff?
Well, look, I've been reading a little bit about some of the horse trading that's been going on in Copenhagen regarding emissions cuts. And you got to remember that one of the things that the main point of conflict has been between industrialized nations versus developing nations. Because Western Europe and the U.S. have offered to do some cuts, significant cuts, in the long term in terms of the emissions. The problem is that China and India have been demanding that the larger developed nation, the more developed nations, actually cut theirs more in order to allow them to emit more, since their emissions per capita are significantly less. Okay, mm-hmm. and that's a big quandary in which people are at right now, because the U.S. and Western Europe have been saying no. it's not exactly like that. I mean, we'll offer these cuts, but you guys have got to curb faster how much your emissions, total emissions, are rising. Okay? And
because at current growth rates, even though the industrialized world has traditionally been responsible for more of such things, at current growth rates, that won't be the case very much longer.
Exactly. So it's a tough draw in that. Also there's been a lot of noise, of course, about the things that have been offered in Copenhagen. Some people in the Senate, whether they're going to even approve anything that that comes out of that anyway. And we talked about this a few weeks back when we about approving treaties, right?
Yep. 67 votes.
Yeah, and I mean, fat chance of getting 67 votes.
Well,
on anything that passes from Copenhagen, well, to be quite honest.
And here's the thing on that: I think the reality, and we mentioned this a few weeks ago too, is that what happens at this point is that in general, you're not going to get, you know, the official ratification of the treaty. You may or may not get legislation that relates to the treaty. What you're going to get is basically the president and the executive branch promising to act as if the treaty was ratified, even though it wasn't.
That's right.
Which means that it's first of all, it means that it's reversible on a whim whenever the president or a new president
changes
later down the line. The president changes their mind, or there's a new president or whatever. Oh, sorry, don't want to do that anymore, because there's no legally binding force behind it. Second is there's a question of just how much the executive can or can't do without legislative approval. However, the trend certainly has been in recent years that basically the legislature does whatever the hell it wants to, regardless of whatever the Congress does. I mean, sorry, the executive does whatever it wants to, regardless of what the legislature does or does not do. And this only really comes to a head when the legislature passes regulations specifically saying, or passes laws specifically saying, the executive cannot do this. And even then, the executive sometimes ignores it. And then, you know, it may take decades in court before anything is ever resolved. And usually something gets worked out so that it doesn't actually ever get resolved. And the end result is the executive can do whatever the hell they feel like. And
You know, but that's even before getting to a treaty. Let me talk about one of the biggest problems developing countries are asking from financing from poor nations want pledges more on the order of $100 billion annually by the end of the next decade in order to help them cut their emissions. $100 billion. I mean, right now, the current pledges that are out there are maybe $30 billion over the next 3 years. So it's only a 1/10, you know, 10% of what they're asking for. And, you know,
here's the thing, too, and I want to jump to this point, because regardless of what is agreed to and whether or not the, you know, U.S. or other countries are actually able to, you know, abide by it in any meaningful way, the bottom line is that even the most ambitious things on the table are probably not enough to make any real significant difference in the problem.
I don't know about that.
From what I've heard about, you know, basically we're talking around the margins about reducing the rate of growth and stuff like that, whereas in order to actually address the underlying problems that have been identified by the scientific community, you actually have to go down and go down significantly and do it quickly. And in some cases, it may already be too late, even if you started today.
Oh boy.
So in many cases, and I've actually said this for a while, yeah, screw trying to figure out how to stop global warming. Let's figure out how to live with it, because it's going to happen.
Well, here's one thing about this though, Sam. I mean, I think that, you know, I can't remember what year was it. There's a year that we had a major blackout in the Northeast.
Yes.
But almost every power plant went offline for a certain number of hours.
Yeah, I remember that.
Somebody actually measured how quickly the air cleaned up.
Yeah, that's okay. Yep.
It was amazingly fast. okay? The levels of stuff that they thought would take years to clean up cleaned up so quickly.
Well, and okay. one of the major parts of this was, you know, another example of this, besides the blackout, was after 9/11, when air travel stopped over the United States, the difference in cloud cover, due to the fact that you didn't have airplane contrails, which actually seeded cloud formation, was noticeable almost immediately as well. Yeah, so...
Which leads me here's my point about this. You know, if we actually at one point said, you know, we really wanted to make a technological switch quickly. I mean, let's face it, we could go over 5 years and by policy, I don't know, say global warming starts getting really bad and the government finally, oh my God, we really should have done something earlier. Well, you know what? We're starting to build 70 nuclear power plants that will be online in 5 years, and we're outlawing all the coal power plants, and we're going into a national energy conservation program in which right now we're going to shut off a third of coal capacity by, you know, having people, you know, switch right now this off and whatever, you know, drastic things. I tell you,
well,
drastic.
Some of the things for like. Yeah. For example, one of the things that's pointed out is if you look mathematically at miles per gallon standards for our cars,
mm-hmm.
The amount that you save by, say, reducing the average mileage of new cars sold by, you know, a mile per gallon or whatever,
mm-hmm.
ends up being dwarfed if you had just said, for instance, you know, no cars over 10 years old allowed on the road.
On the road. That's it. You know, they're all done. I'm sorry. They're all made illegal. Okay? You know what? You can't drive them.
But you know...
You got to take them to a scrap heap. Here's the thing.
Like, if the government actually tried to do anything that radical, do you honestly think they could get away? Well, like, I mean...
If it's an emergency, but you see, here's the thing. It's like everything. Sometimes people don't take action unless they see an emergency.
And look, here's the thing. And with this kind of... issue, and this is part of what I've always said too, is like people get all upset, like we're not taking this preemptive action to address problems before they happen. What's going to happen is the problems will solve themselves semi-naturally once the problem gets bad enough.
That's right.
Now, the question is that people are worried about is there a sort of tipping point of no return kind of thing where by the time it's bad enough so that the man on the street is like, okay, I admit this is bad. I'm going to stop driving my old car, or I'm not going to drive except when I really need to, or whatever. By the time it gets bad enough that kind of thing is happening, or people are not, you know, doing air travel, you know, except in emergencies or whatever, by the time that kind of stuff happens, it's too late. You're past the tipping point.
Well, I think that, you know what, I think that I don't know if that's going to happen. I have high doubts that we'll get to that point. I think that there's a couple of things that are happening at the same time, Sam. I think that technology, as we know it, moves sometimes relatively fast. And sometimes things that we think are impossible 10 years now, right now, in 10 years, maybe a lot easier and simpler than we look
at. There are two things here. Yeah. Once the appropriate pressure is in place that says, you know, hey, we have to have an alternative because what we're doing now just plain isn't working. Yes, things do tend to move relatively quickly. And so you could have, you know, like for instance, for efficient vehicles and such, that is not really going to happen until the price of, you know, oil-based fuel like gasoline, you know, skyrockets. Like you saw people panicking when it hit $4.
Let me tell you something. But it's been happening right now.
And I know it's happening.
We're talking about this, but let me put it this way: gasoline consumption in the United States has been down right now for 3 straight years.
Yeah, no, okay? I understand. I'm talking about like, but you know, if gas, you know, you saw how people were when it was $4 a gallon.
Sure.
And as soon as it dropped back down to 3 or 2.5 or whatever, people are like,
but let me tell you something. Exactly. We get another at some point it may happen, we get another very large price spike. Say it goes to five.
Well, that's what I was going to say. If it goes to like five or six, you know.
Boom. It's amazing how quickly people change behavior.
That's right. It's amazing
how people quickly change behavior.
But on the other hand, if you tried to enforce that by, say, adding a $2 a gallon gas tax, everybody who voted for that would be out of office at the next election.
Well, you know, in Europe, it hasn't happened. I mean, let's face it, Europe emits half of the greenhouse emissions per capita than the U.S.
Well, you know, but it happened somewhat gradually over time, or, you know, it's happened a long time ago in some cases. If you tried to do that here, it would not go over well.
I don't know. You know, I think, but if you did something where you gradually phasing in those taxes, okay, and right now you've given, let's face it, there is a new mandate for auto companies, foreign and domestic, you know, whatever they're based, that for cars that are sold in the U.S., that they have to meet significantly higher gas mileage standards.
True. We are over time, so I just wanted to add one last thing. The other place where I think you will get more intense research efforts, if the global warming problem proves to start getting worse and start getting worse quickly, is geoengineering stuff, where, you know, okay, on the one hand, you can try to change people's behavior and all that other kind of stuff. On the other hand, you can try to figure out other ways to make it colder. And there are a number of ideas out there. Most are considered to be almost completely impractical at this point of time. But as technology increases and as the need increases, that equation will change. I mean, if you have a technological solution where you can, you know, spray some sort of crap in the atmosphere and it cools the area underneath, or, you know, or other kinds of stuff. I mean, there are all kinds of some are
blow a couple of volcanoes.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I've suggested myself, you know, there was all this talk about nuclear winter. I mean, if it gets too hot, just blow up a few thousand nukes somewhere and make yourself a nuclear winter and problem solved.
What about the radiation?
Ah, screw that. A little mutation can be good for a species sometimes.
Oh, okay. Oh, I didn't think about those benefits. Okay, great.
You know, so... You know, but look, there are ways to do that.
I think that idea needs a little work.
I don't know. I think we could try it.
Okay, great. All right.
Anyway, there are all kinds of ideas that are very out there in terms of it. But the point, and, you know, people always point out the risk, too, that if you play with things you don't really understand, you could have all sorts of unintended consequences.
But this is the other thing I'll say. I think there's so many people working on green energy. Say, for example, about 3 or 5 years, they come up with ways that you can generate wind, solar, or whatever that's actually cheaper than the fossil fuels. You talked about the same way that a price spike of gasoline could cause people to do it. The same way that making that cheaper can make people go and say, well, shit, let's do that.
Well, yeah, I mean, and people have figured out that, I forget the exact area, but, you know, you could take a relatively compact area in the middle of the Sahara Desert, and by putting the right, with existing technology, putting the right sort of technology to funnel that solar power and generate electricity, you could serve all of Europe.
There you go.
Yeah, you know, now, would it cost a crap load of money? Absolutely. But you know, think
about the long-term savings.
So anyway, well, we'll see. We're way over time. So we'll see what comes out of here. My prediction is nothing much. Anyway.
We'll see what happens.
We'll see what happens. Thank you all for joining us on Curmudgeon's Corner this week. As usual, email me at abulsme@abulsme.com. That's ABULSME. And let us know your thoughts, questions, comments, whatever, and we'll talk about them on the next week's show, or leave a comment on abulsme.com when I post the new podcast. And of course, tell your friends, whether you like the show or not, tell all your friends to listen.
Yes.
And that's it for this week. Goodbye.
Bye-bye.
Okay, thank you, Yvonne.
Bye.
Have a good start at your new job.
Yes. Okay, bye-bye.
Okay, bye.